striking, and she was as trim as ever. She never seemed to put on a pound. Indulgence was not in Babe's nature, and she was reaping the benefits now. Unlike Slim, who automatically patted her chin, feeling the flesh give way, even wiggle a little. Was Slim jealous of Babe? She told herself she wasn't. She told herself that Babe was her one and only female friend. The only one she'd never felt in competition with, because there simply was no comparison. Babe was in her own class. And Slim always saw how that could be a lonely existence, one that she herself didn't really covet. She saw it in sharp relief today. Babe had been overjoyed to see her, but not before Slim had caught a glimpse of raw fear in her friend's eyes. "Then thank you very much, dearest Babe." "Oh, good." And Babe beamed, the pucker between her eyes relaxed. "Let's pick something out that's perfect." "Yes, perfect." Slim followed Babe, who now strode through the department with confidence, her exquisite taste unquestionable as she sorted through hangers, delicately picked through piles. Soon she had a small but absolutely breathtaking assortment of gowns in Slim's exact size. God, for the days when she was a six. And Slim found herself in an elaborate dressing room filled with more furniture than most small apartments, trying them all on. "Now, do not look at the price tags," Babe instructed in a soothing voice through the closed door. "Promise?" "Promise," said Slim, as she studied herself in a mirror, turning so she could see her backside, lifting her breasts with her hands and frowning as they fell back into middle-aged place. "Babe?"
"Yes, dear?"
"I didn't mean what I said earlier. Of course Truman will still have time for us. We're his swans, remember? I was only being flippant. He's still our true heart." There was a long pause. Then Babe murmured,
"Thank you."
"Now." Slim threw open the dressing room door with a grand gesture, just like Claudette Colbert in a movie from the 30s. She swept around the little parlor where Babe was perched on a chair, enjoying another tiny cup of tea. Posing, posturing, Slim modeled the most exquisite and expensive of the gowns. A white silk one with delicate black embroidered flowers across the cups and straps. It plunged down in the back to just barely above her tailbone, and the silk felt like cool lips on her skin. "What do you think?"
"I think whoever it's for will be unable to resist you for a second."
"Then I'll take it. And thank you, my dearest friend." Slim ran to Babe and threw her arms about her, kissed her on the cheek, then fled back to the dressing room, leaving them both breathless and slightly dizzy from the unexpected physical contact. They simply didn't do that normally. Friendship among their set was sedate, wry, at arm's length. But something about Babe today, how pale, how uncertain she had looked before Slim called out to her, her hesitancy in discussing Truman, touched Slim to the core. In taking Babe's gift, Slim felt she was giving instead. Giving Babe something she very much needed. "Let's go make sure Truman doesn't forget us," Slim urged, after Babe had paid for the gown. "Let's go buy him the kind of present that he likes. Something shiny and garish and too damn expensive for him to ignore."
"That's a wonderful idea," Babe's eyes lit up. "Something for his new apartment. I know exactly what he needs. He saw the most exquisite foo dogs at this little antique store on 7th Avenue.
7th Avenue it is. As the two women exited Bergdorf's,
The CBS limo was already waiting for them. Mr. Stevens had done his job well. They handed their purchases, wrapped up in the signature Bergdorf purple, to the driver, who carefully placed them in the trunk. Then they sank down into the seats and were driven 2 blocks west.
"It's fun, sometimes, pretending," Babe said.
"What do you mean?"
"Oh, today.
Today I just pretended I was someone else. It was fun, in a way. Not to be me. Just to be a person. A normal person."
Slim gnawed her lip, watching her friend settle happily into the plush leather of the sedan. She looked outside the window. They were stuck in traffic, people walking briskly by. They could have strolled to the shop faster than their luxurious car was moving.
"Darling babe," Slim murmured, taking her friend's hand.
"What?"
"Nothing. Just don't pretend too often, please. I love you just the way you are. And so does Bill. And so does Truman."
Babe blushed and folded her arms. She looked outside and didn't say a word. But Slim glimpsed a tear rolling down her cheek, reflected in the discreetly tinted windows of the town car.
Chapter 12. New York loved a parade. For war heroes, baseball players, prize fighters, presidents, holidays. Ticker tape raining down from the tallest buildings, ridiculous giant balloons floating down Broadway for Thanksgiving, fireworks over the Statue of Liberty on the 4th of July. But as much as he wanted to, longed to, ached to, Truman Capote could not give himself a parade, or erect a statue in his own honor, or name a park after himself, or rent the Statue of Liberty. Second to parades, statues, and parks, then, New York loved a party. A really splendid soiree, the Mrs. Astor's famous Patriarch's Balls, admission only to the 400 as determined by her little lapdog, Ward McAllister. Mrs. Vanderbilt's costume ball to christen her new mansion, the one that the Mrs. Astor deigned to attend, thus allowing those upstart Vanderbilts into real society, and ushering in the excesses of the Gilded Age. The Bradley Martin's infamous Louis XIV party, given in the middle of one of the worst recessions in American history. The Bradley Martins felt it necessary to leave the country soon after, but every single guest thought it a fabulous time. Then there were the more recent parties before the war, given by the legendary Elsa Maxwell, that corpulent darling of society. Elsa invented the scavenger hunt, heiresses in their evening clothes accosting hobos for scraps of food, canned goods, whatever was on the list, screeching with laughter, running off with prizes, treasure hunts in the ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria, millionaires elbowing one another viciously for tin trinkets and plastic whistles. Then there were the charity galas, and openings galore, one practically every night during the season, socialites and their reluctant husbands dressed to the nines. But it was always for a good cause. It was work, really. One simply had to do her part, no matter how tiring it might be, planning a wardrobe for an entire season, spending hours before the mirror, ensuring that each gown was flattering from any angle, because, really, one could not trust those photographers to capture the most beguiling aspect. But there hadn't been a truly grand party, an honest-to-God, honey-let's-get-grandmama's-tiara-out fancy dress party in decades. And Truman decided it was his duty to rectify this. All summer long, The summer of 1966, the golden summer, as even then he knew he would look back on it, the summer of his ascendancy to the very top of the world, literary, popular, social. Truman sang a little tune to himself. Well, did you ever, what a swell party, a swell party, a swelligant, elegant party this is. For Truman was going to throw himself a party, in lieu of a parade. A party so grand, so exclusive, it would keep him in the headlines for months. It would make those who weren't invited weep and flee the country, or change their names and go into hiding. It would go down in history as the most, the cherry on top of the sundae, the caviar on top of the toast, the diamond as big as the Ritz. And so that golden summer, as Truman lounged poolside at his friends' mansions, sunned himself on their yachts in the Mediterranean, even on the rare occasions it was only him and Jack, silent but companionable on the beach between their adjacent houses in Southampton, he planned. When he wasn't clipping reviews for his scrapbook, or giving interviews, or posing for photographs. He schemed. He was never without his notebook, a plain, black-covered, lined notebook. And he wrote down and crossed out names over and over and over again, for he was Ward McAllister and the Mrs. Astor, and himself, Truman Capote, literary giant slash social arbiter, all rolled into one. He had the power now, and the money. As he lay on the Agnelli's yacht that summer, refusing to go off on their exhausting little excursions to some ruin or another, smirking when they all trooped back, dusty and footsore, while he had spent the day being served champagne by swarthy stewards, bobbing up and down on the turquoise Mediterranean, admiring the scenery from afar, or lounged by Babe's pool, or danced with Lee Radziwill, Jackie's sister, don't you know, the newest addition to his swans. Truman, on the outside, was the same as ever, the same jokester, prankster, entertainer, the same lapdog, pocket fairy, jester. "I want to pay you all back," he drawled, when questioned about his notebook, which he guarded fiercely, joked that he kept it locked up in a safe at night. "You've all been so kind to me, giving me parties, dinners, vacations even. Morella, your yacht, it is to die for, a floating palace. So it's the least I can do, to throw a little old party in return." "Yes, I want to pay you all back," he said to himself. "I want to make you jump through the hoops. Amuse me, amuse me. I want you to remember just who I am now, Truman Capote, the acclaimed author of the acclaimed In Cold Blood, the book that everyone is talking about this summer of 1966. The book none of you shallow idiots could ever have written. I'm not just your little true heart, your favorite dinner guest, your token fag. I'm just as powerful as you. And just as glamorous. And just as headline-worthy. And infinitely more interesting. Still, as rich as he now was from the proceeds of the book, rich enough to make Nina slash Lily May spin in her urn, rich enough, finally, to move from dreary Brooklyn into a stunning Manhattan apartment at the new UN Plaza, an apartment that Babe helped him decorate with heady views of the East River, the Brooklyn Bridge, Lower Manhattan. Rich enough to buy Jack's Southampton house for him, in his own name, and give it to him as a present, possibly the most generous act of his life. And thinking about it, still brought tears to his eyes. rich enough to throw this party. Still, he wasn't rich enough to own a yacht, or a plane, or a television network. So he bit his tongue and planned his party gleefully, telling all his swans that of course they'd be invited, why they'd be the very top of the list. Still, it wouldn't do to throw the party for himself, far too tacky even for him, and he couldn't throw it for any of his swans. Dear God, what a tangle of shredded feathers, rent designer gowns, torn jewels that would be. No. Best to throw it for someone else, someone rather small and dreary, someone not nearly as fabulous as him, if he was going to have to share the spotlight. Someone like Kay Graham. Poor Kay. Poor plain Kay, the wife of Phil Graham, a tragic suicide. Poor Kay, left with pots of money and a newspaper, the Washington Post, to run. Poor Kay of Washington, D.C., that dowdy little town where women did not dress for lunch, where they did not get their hair done by Kenneth, where their parties were soggy with politicians and other earnest drabs who talked more than they drank. Poor Kay, whom Babe had introduced him to and whom Truman had immediately liked, because of her very plainness. Just as he'd been drawn to Alvin and Marie Dewey, of Kansas, whom he'd met while researching In Cold Blood. Alvin was the lead detective on the case. Just as he was drawn irresistibly to truck drivers and appliance repairmen and dumb, brawny dock workers. Truman knew he had a fascination for the ordinary that almost overshadowed his fascination with the rich and famous. He truly couldn't live without either. He'd left many a dinner in a penthouse apartment on Fifth to go down to the docks and pick up a teamster. So, Kay. Dowdy, pitiful Kay, who, he insisted in a phone call that summer, needed cheering up. "No, not really," she replied, puzzled. "I'm just fine, Truman." "No, you're not. I'm going to give you a party, just a little party, to put a smile back on your face. You don't have to, but if you want to, I'd be honored." "Fine, it's settled then. Just an intimate party with dear friends." By August, that intimate party had swelled to 500 dear friends. Only 500. Maybe 540, no more, because that was all the grand ballroom at the Plaza Hotel could comfortably hold, and that was to be the setting for this intimate little cheering-up party for his good friend, poor Kay Graham. He, Truman, was giving a party at the Plaza. "Mama, Mama, look at me now!" "Now, Morella, don't feel put out. I couldn't have you as the guest of honor because everyone else would be jealous, but I will need you to host a pre-party dinner, sweetheart, if you don't mind. I'm only asking a very few of my dearest friends." "Now, Slim, Big Mama, darling, of course you'll be tops of the guest list. But I couldn't have you as the guest of honor. Can you imagine how furious La Guinness would be? Knives would be thrown, daggers. But I'm saving the first dance for you, my darling." "Now, Gloria, don't get furious. But you couldn't be the guest of honor. That's going to be Kay Graham, poor Kay. But you know, don't you, darling, that you're the guest of honor in my heart of hearts. And I'm instructing you to wear your finest jewelry, because it's going to be fancy, fancy, and you'll be the belle of the ball anyway." "CZ, my pet, what fun we're going to have! I know you won't mind if you're not the guest of honor. You know Kay Graham, don't you? Poor Kay. I decided she needed some cheering up, so she's going to be the center of attention, because she needs it. But really, who'll be looking at her? Poor dreary soul, when you're there, the golden goddess of all time." "Babe, Bobolink, my heart, Of course I thought of you right away when I wanted to throw a party. I longed to give it for you, in your honor, after all we've been through together. But can you imagine how Slim would feel, the poor dear? Her life with that dreadful English lord is dreary enough. But I absolutely will rely on you for help and planning. And would you be the dearest of dears and host a pre-party dinner? I'm asking only a few really special friends so that some of the guests who won't have escorts won't have to arrive alone. Everyone can dine together and arrive en masse. And Marella, Slim, Gloria, CZ, Babe. All that summer, while they indulged their favorite, showed him off, now even more in demand than ever, a true prize at the dinner table, an intellectual feather in their jeweled caps, all murmured and agreed and felt special, singled out, and superior to poor K. Graham, who was a dowdy, dear soul. And so Truman cackled and rubbed his hands with glee, a Machiavellian party planner, and dangled and withheld, delighting to see all Manhattan dancing at his feet, begging to be invited to what was already, that summer, shaping up to be the biggest event of the season. Truman dropped hints in the press. He called up his famous friends and drawled into their famous ears, tantalizing, purring. So Tony Curtis, my favorite actor of all time, you'll be in Manhattan in November, won't you? Tony Curtis, his favorite actor of all time, that day anyway, cleared his schedule and waited for an invitation that never appeared. Carson, darling, my pet, my favorite author. You'll be in town in November, of course. And Carson McCullers, former friend and champion of a then-unknown writer named Truman Capote, waited until she heard, via Norman Mailer, that she wasn't invited. Then she grandly announced she'd be giving her own party that same night. But no one paid any attention. All summer long, Truman schemed and planned and finalized. The guest list was the major work, and he spent as much time agonizing over it as he had any of his manuscripts. It had to be perfect. It had to be a unique mix of the beautiful people, the wealthy, the respected, the new and exciting, for this was 1966. 1966! And the Beatles were absolutely it, and people were dancing the go-go at the Cheetah, and Andy Warhol was holding parties of his own at his workspace, the factory, and skirts were up to there, and hair down to here, and Frank Sinatra had just married Mia Farrow. Frank Sinatra. Mia Farrow. Truman scribbled their names down, along with Ali Khan, Linda Bird Johnson, but not Lady Bird. God, no, he didn't want any dreary Secret Service men invading his party. Candace Bergen, Henry Fonda, the Windsors, for the expected touch of royalty. Cecil Beaton, Henry Ford III, McGeorge Bundy, Norman Mailer, the Deweys and their friends from Kansas, Bennett and Phyllis Cerf, of course, the doorman at his new apartment building, Jack, Margaret Truman, not Bess or Harry, Alice Roosevelt, the Whitneys, naturellement, a couple of Vanderbilts and Astors, just for nostalgia's sake. Should he invite the Beatles? Nah. But Andy Warhol, definitely. Christopher, of course, Christopher Isherwood, and John Knowles. He thought briefly of the entire Pulitzer Prize Committee, sure to award In Cold Blood the prize for nonfiction in the upcoming year, but decided against that as too calculated even for him. Greta Garbo, Marlena Dietrich, the Harry Belafontes, Tallulah Bankhead, who was apt to show up naked, please, God, think of the publicity. Rudolf Nureyev, definitely. George Balanchine, There would be dancing, of course. Better book Peter Duchin now. Betty Bacall, Pamela and Leland Hayward. Well, hell, of course he had to invite them. Surely Slim was over that whole thing by now. The cab driver who took Truman home for free one night because he'd had his wallet stolen at a dive bar. Rose Kennedy. Ethel and Bobby, his neighbors at the UN Plaza. Jackie, naturally, although Truman had taken to whispering to anyone who would listen that she looked like a drag version of herself in person. For every name added, there were two crossed out, perhaps to be added later, or not. Truman was God, and not a benevolent one either. Old grievances were dredged up. Of course, Carson McCullers wouldn't be invited, the sow. The bitchy, envious sow who had turned on him ever since he became more acclaimed than she was, and forget Gore Vidal, that bitch. Anne Woodward could forget it, too, and not just because she was a murderess. They'd met at a party at the Windsors not too long ago, where the other guests were giving her a wide berth. Anne was standing alone, one arm on the fireplace mantel, surveying the crowd. Truman strolled right up to her. "Well, if it isn't Miss Bang Bang herself," he had greeted her. "Seen any burglars lately?" "Well, if it isn't Truman Capote, literary asshole and garden variety fag," Anne had slurred back. She was stoned. Her eyes were glazed over, her lipstick smeared all over her face, and Wallace was surveying her grimly, visibly regretting having invited her. But some people had started to feel sorry for her, trapped in Elsie's golden grip, and she was starting to make the rounds again. Then she threw her drink in his face, chest heaving, pupils dilated. She had a twisted grin of triumph on her Cherry Street lips. "You don't fool me, you little queer. You're just as pathetic as I am. Maybe more pathetic." "You'll regret this," he assured her calmly, as she was hastily ushered away, cackling wildly, by one of Wallace's lapdogs. He was already starting to plot his revenge. But that was for later. After. Right now, the only thing he wanted to work on, could work on, was his party. Throwing this party meant he didn't have to worry about what to write next. He'd worked himself raw, scraped his soul to the marrow, writing in cold blood. At first it was just a diversion, a small article in the Times about a murdered Kansas family that piqued his interest. He thought it might make a nice little piece for the New Yorker, something about a murder in a small town, the shocking randomness of it, the reverberations. So he convinced William Shawn, the editor, to send him out to Kansas so he could report on it. That was all. But from the moment he laid eyes on Dick, stupid, blustering Dick, and Perry, mesmerizing, charismatic Perry, at the tiny Kansas courthouse, the night the two men were arrested for the murders of the Clutter family, he knew that he had something more. His masterpiece. A case study, a brilliant piece of journalism, written with the lyricism of a novel. "In fact, I've invented a new genre, the non-fiction novel," he never tired of telling anyone who would listen. Back in 1959, when the whole thing started, he spent endless weeks in Holcomb, Kansas, gathering the material, interviewing the townsfolk, trying to understand the doomed Clutters, getting cozy with the lead detective, granite-faced Alvin Dewey, and his adorable wife, Marie, getting even cozier with the arrested, and then convicted murderers, Dick Hickok and Perry Smith, and understanding the latter better, more intimately, than he ever did the Clutters. When he returned to New York and settled down with his notebooks to write, it had been easy, for a change. The manuscript flowed from his fingertips on its own, and he told absolutely everyone about it, and soon everyone in New York was salivating to read it. And he would give them glimpses, little performances of certain scenes at parties and dinners. But then the waiting, the everlasting, tortuous waiting for the end. The end. Oh, how he longed to write it, but he couldn't, not for years, agonizing years that dragged on while Dick and Perry were granted stay after stay, pleading with him, Truman, their great hope, their chronicler, to help them. Years in which all he could do was talk about this great opus, not finish it, even while he had to watch Nell Harper Lee win all the prizes for her story about their childhood, To Kill a Mockingbird. Oh, Christ! The pain of watching that happen to Nell, of all people! Clumsy, inarticulate Nell. And the fear, shocking, jolting him awake at night so that his heart raced, his body swam in clammy sweat, that people would lose interest in the story. And him. And then he would be just another writer, and not the greatest of all time. But finally, there were no more stays, no more last-minute calls from the governor, and the executions, oh God, oh Jesus, oh Mama. They'd shamed him into being there. Dick and Perry, and yes, Nell, who'd helped him research it, and William Shawn, who expected blood, no less, for what he was paying Truman, so he'd gone to see Perry and Dick only an hour before their execution. They were white as sheets, were still trying to be brave, flippant, but obviously terrified, poor boys. What had Truman felt, talking to them this last time? He hadn't processed it all. He wasn't brave enough for that. Truman knew he was a coward in many ways. It was, he believed, one of the most charming things about him. That night, it was near midnight, dark, raining, a horrible, bone-chilling nightmare that he knew had seeped into his very being, and that he would carry with him forever. His cowardice and bravery both astonished him. The cowardice that had kept him from going to Dick and Perry despite their pleas, until the very last moment when there would be no time for them to say what he knew they would, that he had deserted them, given up on them, used them. But he had come, after all, and his bravery overwhelmed him, the courage to stay when the two murderers asked him to witness their final moments, the barbaric ritual, the last words, the hoods over the heads, the knees buckling, the tortured writhing at the end of the noose, and then, finally, the eerie stillness, the absence of breathing, the one less person in the cavernous barn, despite the fact that there were still the same number of bodies. The subtraction of a soul. The tragic waste of lives, not unlike his own, if he was being honest, lives of men abandoned by their parents, treated like crap, like dirt, like fungus. All their lives. Men who had taken one turn, while he had taken another, and that simple act of a change in direction, in wind, in air, of one foot in front of another, was all that separated the two of them, killer and artist. But a killer could be an artist, he discovered, and an artist, a killer. The soul-searching, the exhaustion of reality, of bearing witness, of coming to the aid of a fellow man, even a killer, he must hold it all at bay. He could not examine it, for fear of what it would do to the work which was the most important thing. This masterpiece he had crafted, astonishing himself with every perfect word, every exquisitely crafted paragraph. The book was all. He must write it, and he did, that last chapter coming quickly for a change, as usually he agonized over endings. And the book was all he had dreamed it would be, all he had told everyone, his swans, his literary rivals, the doorman to his apartment building, the grocer on the corner, his crazy family back in Alabama, even his sniveling deadbeat of an attention-hog father. In Cold Blood was a masterpiece, and this time the critics all agreed. And now that he was at the top of the heap, had become that spire in the great city, beckoning others from lesser lands, he must rejoice in his success, for enjoying the fruits of his labor was just as serious as the writing itself. So now he was throwing a party, the most swelligant, elegant party ever, in honor of Mrs. Catherine Graham. Mr. Truman Capote requests the pleasure of your company at a black-and-white dance on Monday, the 28th of November, at 10 o'clock. Grand Ballroom, The Plaza. Later, Truman said that the morning the invitations went out, he made 500 friends and 1,500 enemies. Only one of these was an exaggeration.
Chapter 13. A summit, a council of utter fabulousness. The day before Truman's party, Betsy Cushing Roosevelt Whitney, accompanied by her sisters, Minnie Cushing Astor Fosburgh and Barbara Cushing Mortimer Paley, sailed into the Palm Court at the Plaza. Her head held high, she didn't slow down, only barely nodded at the maitre d', who scurried ahead of her to pull out a chair just as she sat down at an intimate table, one of her own choosing. Betsy Cushing Roosevelt Whitney did not wait to be told where to sit, not even at the Plaza. It was afternoon tea. All around them were adorable little girls dressed in pink dresses with matching hair ribbons, white gloves, patent leather shoes, accompanied by indulgent parents or grandparents. There were other lesser socialites present, too, and out-of-towners who couldn't help but gape at the trio of fabulously dressed women, all with cheekbones as prominent as their good breeding. But the triumvirate paid the tourists no attention. This was a sister meeting, a ritual from their childhood. Long ago, their tribunals had centered around who could borrow whose hair ribbon, or what birthday present they should pool their money for and purchase for their mother. But as they grew up and into the beauty and elegance laid out for them, like their school uniforms, by their mother, the conferences had turned to more serious matters, usually presided over by Goggs. Minnie's long affair with Vincent Astor, for instance, had been discussed and dissected and determined to have run long enough at one of their summits. Vincent found himself proposing soon after. And Babe's miserable marriage to Stanley Mortimer had come to a merciful end after one of their conclaves. Goggs and her daughters had weighed the pros and cons and finally determined that Babe could remove herself with her reputation intact. And so, she did. There had been no summit, however, when Babe decided to marry Bill. Tea, too, was a constant from the sisters' youth. Back in the big Cushing house in Brookline, their mother, Goggs, had introduced the ritual of afternoon tea, ostensibly for the family, but before long it became a salon of a sort, a place where the best and most socially desirable of the medical and academic communities could drop in. Every afternoon, a tempting assortment of tea and punch and finger sandwiches and pastries would be spread in the drawing room and a crush of people would arrive. The Cushing sisters grew up watching their mother preside over the tea table
and flit among her guests, seeing to their every wish and comfort. Their father, however, rarely attended. He was always in surgery. The girls watched, and it wasn't for amusement. Goggs insisted on their being involved in the preparations long before they were old enough to take part in these elegant soirees. They observed their mother see to every detail, no matter how small. The spotlessness of the aprons worn by the Irish servant girls, the ritualistic polishing of the silver, the placement of the cherries atop the pink iced tea cakes. There would often be music, a harpist or a pianist, some Cambridge student hired for the day. Other homes, even in Boston during those playful years of the 1920s, early 30s, might have also served cocktails in silver shakers accompanied by cheese biscuits. But not Goggs. She stuck to tradition, to bone china, English tea, lemon and sugar, clotted cream for the scones. Betsy Whitney, Minnie Fosburg, and Babe Paley, then, were more than capable of hosting elaborate spreads in their own homes. And they often did. But why hide themselves away all the time? It was time for a sister summit. So, naturally, they went to the plaza. For their mother had raised them to be seen and admired. I don't believe Mother ever had tea outside her own drawing room, did she? Betsy, who was not the eldest but acted it, inquired as she removed her gloves. She was a shorter version of Babe, with the same cheekbones, but her coloring was less vivid, her hair a lighter shade, her eyes not quite as dark, her skin not quite as creamy. But Betsy had the more regal air. She could manage to look down her nose at anyone, even if she were the smallest person in the room. Minnie, the eldest and kindest, Babe always insisted, sister, shook her head. Minnie was the tallest, the most down-to-earth. She didn't have Betsy's imperiousness, nor Babe's uncertainty. She didn't have their deep-set brown eyes either, although she was the thinnest. She would have been gawky had she been anyone else's daughter but Goggs's. Babe smiled fondly. No. Mama never did like to dine in public, did she? She always felt the best hospitality could be found at home. A waiter handed Betsy. How did he know she was the leader? He simply did. A beautifully lettered menu, but she waved it away. Champagne and Darjeeling. An assortment of sandwiches and pastries, but no sponge cake. I can't abide sponge cake. No onions on the sandwiches. Then she turned back to her sisters as the waiter bowed and hurried away. I like onions, Minnie protested. Her cheeks flamed as she resumed an argument that had begun when she was 10 and Betsy 8. Just because you don't doesn't mean that I shouldn't have them. Onions aren't proper for ladies. Do you want your breath to offend? Didn't Mama teach you anything? Betsy shook her head and turned to Babe for backup. Babe wrinkled her nose. I don't like them personally, but I don't see why Minnie can't have onions if she wants them. I didn't see why Minnie had to divorce Vincent either, but she did. Betsy didn't even look at her elder sister. It was as if she weren't there. Betsy, don't start. I never wanted to marry Vincent in the first place. I don't think he wanted to marry me. Goggs wanted it, and so, of course, it came off. I put up with him as long as I could. Then I found him Brooke, who needed his money and name more than I did. And then he died, and so what? Who cares? Why did you divorce James, if we're playing that game? Wasn't a Roosevelt good enough for you? James didn't want to be a father to his daughters. I was looking out for my girls, just as Mama always looked out for us. I'm a good mother, Minnie. Not that you'd know anything about that. Betsy narrowed her eyes at her sister. Oh, please. Babe anxiously looked from sister to sister. Girls, please, not here. Mama would be distraught. Babe, we're not making a scene, Betsy scolded her little sister. Our voices are perfectly normal. You worry too much as usual. But let's do change the subject. Tomorrow's Truman's party. Of course, we all know what we're going to wear. It was another rhetorical question. Betsy was fond of asking them. The sisters had coordinated their wardrobes weeks ago, just as they always did prior to a party. From their childhood friends' birthday parties to Truman's fabulous black-and-white ball, the Divine Cushing sisters knew how to dress for maximum trio advantage. Babe always got the first pick, which Betsy had always begrudged but had never been able to change, the one thing perhaps in her life that she had not been able to bend to her will. After Babe made her selection, the other two had to somehow dress in a complementary yet unique fashion, with certain colors deemed special to one or the other. Babe was an angel in blue. That was a truth universally acknowledged. Actually, all jewel tones were hers. Betsy was often in black. Minnie didn't care, and in fact, often simply asked Babe to find something for her to wear, which was a task Babe took great pride in, happy to be of help. When it came to jewelry, however, there was every sister for herself. Betsy had Whitney money, Minnie had Astor heirlooms, Babe had the most modern jewelry, custom designed by newer artistes. Fulco di Verdura, Jean Schlumberger. Well, we're all in white this time, so there's no coordinating to do, Minnie said with obvious relief. Designers? I'm in a Castillo, Babe offered, even though Betsy knew very well who she was wearing. Dior, Betsy replied. Belmont, Minnie offered, as all three sisters nodded in approval of their choices. Masks, I asked Halston to do mine, said Betsy. Same here, Minnie pointed to herself. I asked Adolfo. Actually, I asked him to make three different versions just in case, Babe admitted, lowering her eyes modestly. I provided him with some paste versions of my jewels, and he made up three different designs, and then I picked the one I liked best, and he added the real stones. Oh, Babe! Minnie was so open in her admiration. Her thin face glowed. Oh, that's just like you, darling. Yes, that was very smart of you, Betsy admitted through gritted teeth. You know me, Babe shrugged, even as she was enjoying Betsy's obvious jealousy. I don't like to leave much to chance. Mama taught me that, anyway. There was a lull while the waiter rolled a trolley up to their table, filled with delicate sandwiches the size of silver dollars, luscious sugared cookies, and iced cakes. Each sister smiled in approval, allowed her tea to be poured in her cup, but when the waiter was gone, not one sandwich, cookie, or cake was selected. The onion argument had been moot after all. What about Truman? Betsy asked, moving the agenda along. Are we certain he's done everything right? Babe? Babe stirred her tea slowly. This is Truman's party, Betsy dear. Not ours. I do think you might have forgotten that. Yes, yes, but, well, Truman. He didn't have the upbringing we did, and he's relied on us, all three of us, so much in matters of taste. That new apartment, for instance, you and Minnie practically decorated it for him, didn't you? We did advise, Minnie said, uncrossing then crossing her long legs, clad in silk hosiery, although she wore unbecomingly flat, rather plain shoes, something Betsy never did approve of. Even if Minnie was self-conscious about her height, couldn't she at least wear something stylish, like Babe? It was quite fun, wasn't it, Babe, darling? But I do wonder at all the rattlesnakes he chose. So many stuffed specimens. Too much like the Museum of Natural History. Minnie shuddered, I would say that's an apt metaphor. Betsy pursed her lips. What do you mean by that? Babe shot back. Babe, dear, I simply mean that little Truman has a bit of a sting to him, don't you think? Somewhat of a barbed way of looking at the world. Heaven knows he's been divine to you, to all of us. But he's not always that way to others. This whole party, really, I can't help but think that he could have managed it better. Without quite so much publicity. Why, the Herald leaked the guest list. Leaked? How? Who gave it to them? And now everyone who wasn't invited can't claim that they were and turned it down. The world knows who was invited and, more important, who was not. That's rather bourgeois, don't you think? Truman has a secretary who sent the invitations out, Babe said primly. He wasn't the only one with access to it. Babe, dear, your loyalty, as always, is touching. Betsy's lips curled up. Let's hope tomorrow night isn't a disaster, because, of course, people will assume we all had something to do with it, even if we didn't. Especially you, Babe, as close as the two of you are. I don't think we have to worry. He'll pull it off brilliantly, I know. Babe felt her cheeks flush, heard her voice rising ever so little, and so she sipped some tea and smoothed the skirt of her Chanel day suit. I can't wait to see what you're wearing, Betsy dear. Babe smiled serenely at her older sister. I know you described it to me, but I can't wait to see you in person. Is Jock wearing a mask? I can't get Bill to wear one. No, Jock won't either. Jim is, Minnie beamed. He's spent weeks designing it himself. Naturally, Betsy murmured with a significant look at Babe. I'm not at all surprised, dear, to hear that. What do you think Goggs would say about the party? Minnie mused. She had been her mother's problem daughter. The two had clashed often in private, although in public Minnie generally conformed to her mother's ideals. Betsy was so exactly like her mother that they had always been in agreement. Babe was too insecure ever to question her mother's decrees, except for when she married Bill. That had been quite the time. Minnie grinned, remembering her mother's utter disbelief that Babe, of all her daughters, would marry a Jew. I often wonder how Mama'd feel about Truman, Minnie wondered. I hope she'd like him as much as we do, Babe said quietly. No, she wouldn't, pronounced Betsy the wise. She wouldn't have trusted him one bit. I can't say that I'd blame her either, but he is quite amusing. In small doses. Well, I do know that Mama would never have approved of all this publicity. Photographers at a party. She must be writhing in her grave. But secretly, she'd cut out all our photos and paste them in a scrapbook. And she'd demand to be shown our gowns beforehand. Heavens, the idea of us dressing ourselves at our age. Minnie laughed fondly. She did miss the force of nature that had been her mother. Goggs, for all her prickliness, still had been the compass, the rudder, the sail, the very wind driving her girls toward the safe harbor of wealth and privilege. And it was safe, Minnie had to admit with a sigh. And she was a coward. She knew she'd never have made a good poor man's wife. None of them would have. Well, maybe Babe. The pop of a champagne cork caused all three sisters to shift expectantly in their seats. Cristal was poured into their glasses, and Betsy raised hers first to give the customary toast. To Goggs! To Goggs! Her sisters repeated, and the glasses clinked, causing everyone in the palm-filled room to look and gape once more. Three beautiful women, the three fabulous Cushing sisters,
gracing the plaza with their presence, granting their subjects a glimpse, laughing together, careless, privileged, so exquisite that it was impossible even to envy them. They were simply unattainable. Then the sisters drifted away, blowing air kisses, bestowing smiles of recognition to a chosen few as they made their way to their waiting limousines. After all, they must see to their gowns. They must try them on one last time, in case there were any unexpected tears or loose sequins. They must remember the code to the vault, so that they could retrieve their jewels. They must make sure their husbands had a good dinner, a perfect cigar, so that they were in such good moods they might actually be persuaded to dance tomorrow night. Or at least not mind if the sisters danced with other men. And then, of course, the sisters must also go to bed early, with cucumber slices on their eyes, special facial masks hydrating their skin. For hadn't their mother told them always to get a good 10 hours sleep the night before a party? Chapter 14. The morning of the party, Kay Graham went to have her hair done. Normally, she just had a plain shampoo and set, but she was growing worried. Truman had told her of the elaborate preparations being undertaken by some of his friends, the really elegant ones, the swans, he called them. Marella Agnelli, Slim Keith, Gloria Guinness, Babe Paley. Kay had met them all. In fact, had been introduced to Truman by Babe, who was so elegant, so perfect that Kay always felt dowdy next to her, no matter how nice a dress she was wearing. But Kay was simply missing that elegant, stylish jean, and she knew it. And besides, in Washington, that didn't matter so much. But in New York, it did. And tonight she was going to be on display. "Darling, you must look divine. All the newspapers will be sending photographers. Television networks, too. All eyes will be on you, my darling, precious Kay." Truman meant to be kind, she knew. He was excited for her. But his words filled Kay with despair, that familiar self-doubt. Frankly, she wished she could just stay in her hotel suite at the plaza and watch television or read a book. But she couldn't. And so, taking a deep breath, she grabbed her purse and ran out of the plaza in her plain clothes, a cotton dress, low-heeled pumps. She hadn't put any makeup on, as she normally didn't wear any. She did plan to wear something, mascara, lipstick, tonight. Grabbing a cab, she repeated the address given to her by Truman himself. In fact, he had set the appointment for her. "Kay, gorgeous lady, you have to see Kenneth. He's the one, the only one." And certainly Kay had heard of Kenneth. After all, she knew the Kennedys when they were in the White House, and Kenneth styled Jackie's hair. So, of course, Kay guessed that Kenneth's might be a little busy today, the day of her party. But nothing prepared her for the crush in front of the place. Nothing prepared her for the place at all, really. Her salon in Washington was small, utilitarian, on the top floor of a retail building. "Is this it?" Kay asked the cabbie, who shrugged and thrust out his hand for the fare. She paid it, got out of the cab, and couldn't prevent herself from simply stopping and gaping, like the tourist she was. For in front of an enormous limestone townhouse, a stunning building with columns and pediments and majestic windows and a festive yellow and black awning in front, was a line of limousines, town cars and cabs. She wondered if the president himself might be here, for in Washington, the only time you saw a crush like this was when the president or vice president was out and about, trailed by the Secret Service. There wasn't a lot of honking. The drivers seemed patient enough, willing to wait. And emerging from the awning, popping out like BBs from a toy gun, were women. gorgeous, stylish women, far better dressed than she was, in designer dresses and furs. Kate immediately folded her arms across her chest, ashamed of her plain shift dress and cloth coat, acutely aware of her lack of jewelry and makeup. And on the heads of these women were concoctions.